Thank you, Beena. Hi, folks. My name's Graham. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Graham.
I'm a member of the acceptance group in Guelph. That's the Monday night group, and we meet on Friday. I love the kind of disorganization of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's the only... You can tell by my accent that I'm not from this part of the world. In fact, there's a part of me that's Irish and part of me that's Scottish, and that's kind of a bad combination because one part wants to get drunk all the time, another part doesn't want to pay for it. I go to a lot of AA meetings, and I always learn something, and I've been at this meeting for, 15 minutes, and I've learned something already. Beena said that this was the main part of the meeting. I always thought that was the seventh tradition. So I'm learning something tonight, and I'm grateful for that. I want to begin formally by thanking the committee for inviting me. Graham, I know, was your speaker for the conference, and I met Graham at a 7 a.m. AA meeting in June, and we talked, and we had coffee, and we took part in the meeting, and then I met him again the next morning at the same time, and I think I met him at an AA meeting that evening as well. And I never thought out of all the conversations that we had, I would end up standing up here doing this. I think if I'd thought about it, I probably would have ignored them completely. However, I'm very, very grateful to be asked. You know, there's been a time in my life when I wasn't asked to go anywhere. In fact, I was encouraged not to go. And it was really very nice to be asked to become and be part of this, but I'm only half of me. I have a wife that we kind of kid on, and we call her American Express, because literally I don't leave home without her. But this evening I did, because we have five children. Three of our boys happen to be baseball players, and it so happened that today is championship weekend in baseball in Guelph. Now, when the invitation to come to the conference came in, we recognized that that might be a conflict, but we thought it was highly unlikely that one team would make it to the championship final. We thought it would be totally impossible that two teams would, and there was just no way that three teams would get to the championship finals. And so we arranged for a babysitter, and we arranged to come together. You need to know that all three teams made it to championship day today. And when I left, two of the three teams had not gone on, but one was still playing and may well be on to the championship final tomorrow. And so as a recovering family, what we did about a week ago, 10 days ago, is we sat down with the three little guys and we said, look, this is the options, here are the choices, and let's talk about them. And the conclusion in this recovering family was that Dad come because he has to, and Mum stays behind because she has to as well, and the kids would love to be here. They were at the Guelph Convention about 3 weeks ago. And I was the closing speaker, and it was the first time my little guys, the 11-year-old and the twin boys who were 9, had heard Dad's story. They don't remember Dad's practicing. They were too little to see Dad drinking and other things that went on. But they know that Dad's in AA, and Mum goes to Al-Anon, and they go to a thing called Aladude, which is pre-Alateen. And they come to my birthday, and they hang out more with my sponsor than I do, and they just, we're a recovering family. And I believe in a family that is ill as I was, we are as ill as our secrets. And I believe that in my secrets lies my sickness. And so we sit down as a family and we talk about what we want to do and where we're going to go and what we all feel. And we're all very grateful to be invited to be part of this, and we're just sorry that we can't all be here. So thank you on behalf of the committee again. Many, many thanks for asking me. Beena mentioned that Bob D and Tommy H were here earlier on, and it's interesting that they both happen to have not been in the room. I know Tommy's speaking in Whitby, and I don't know where Bob is. Maybe he'll be here, or maybe he's here or not. But the point is that these guys have heard me speak before. And I recognize that having spoken at some other places, some of you in the room here may have heard me before. And so if you feel in the middle of the talk it's all old hat and you want to get up and leave, there's a part of me that will understand. But the alcoholic part of me will never forget your face. And I will have yet another resentment that I will have to work through over time with punching my sponsor. It's very easy, you know, when you're invited to a conference like this and somebody blowing on a funny-looking bag walks in ahead of you and people stand up and applaud and you're introduced in a very nice way to start to think that maybe you're getting a little bit of a big shot. And I have to be very careful about that. You know, I have to be very careful that my ego and my pride and my arrogance doesn't get back to the way it was when I was really ill. And so I like to start my talks in a consistent way, and I try and do it by telling a story against myself that's a little bit humorous, because if I don't do this, my sponsor, Punchy P, who some of you will know, will certainly do it tomorrow. The job that I do, I'm a doctor and I work with alcoholics and drug addicts, and that's my job, and I've done it for a number of years. And because there's not many doctors working with alcohol and drug addicts, sometimes the media go out looking for a doctor who might know what he's talking about, and they sometimes ask me for an opinion. It's nice of them. They get an opinion, whether it's right or wrong, but they get an opinion. And anyhow, I was invited to go on the 100 Huntley Street, you know, that religious program, and give an interview on TV. Well, I tell you, that was pretty impressive to this alcoholic, and I thought, this is great. And so I phoned up most of my relatives and warned them I was going to be in TV, and then this kind of thing, make sure you turn it on. So I got in there, and it was being videotaped, and the lights were hot, and the cameras were running, And David, what's his name, was halfway through. He asked me the first question, and I was halfway through my response, and I thought to myself, you know, I'm really doing well here. But all of a sudden, in the dark behind the camera, the producer's voice said, cut, 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 cut. Would somebody dust his head, the light shining off it? I've discovered that life is a way of bringing me down to earth very, very quickly. And I think that's probably appropriate. You know, I really do believe that I'm given things on a daily basis that I can handle, and although I'm very nervous speaking to you this evening, I'm in the right place. I'm in the place where I was made to feel normal. It's important that I say to you that I'm here because I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I was told by the man who 12-stepped me some years ago that if you want to keep this gift of sobriety, you need to give it away, and this is one of the several different ways that I try to give it away. I'm not an expert in AA. I'm not an expert in recovery. I'm simply an alcoholic that's staying sober a day at a time with a program that was given to me for fun and for free, and I'm trying to do the same thing back. I would like you to ask you to identify what you can, and what you can't identify, discard. Please don't compare, and if you want to judge, that's your business. But I'm very grateful to be asked to stand up and be given the gift of sharing a little piece of me with you, because by doing this, you give me the gift of staying well another day at a time, and that is priceless, and I don't know how to thank you for that. I have learned that if I live sober, I can love myself. And if I can love myself, I can love you. And the way I find love is often with laughter. I'm from an alcoholic home. I grew up in Glasgow, Scotland. I'm from an alcoholic home. And I'm not blaming the parents for the alcoholism. I didn't know their disease was a disease. I just thought it was violence, it was anger, it was inconsistency, it was fear, it was shame. But out of that difficult environment came some positive things for me. I discovered that if I worked a little bit harder, if I did a little bit better, if I tried a little bit more, maybe I'd be able to change the parent who was violent and drinking and insecure and obviously unhappy. And so I became what we all call an overachiever. I'm not quite sure what that is, but I tried harder and harder. And as a result, I became able to study. And I would try and get better and better grades, and as a little boy, I'd take those grades in looking for parental approval. But in my home, the message that was given to me was, I will love you if you're perfect. And so I became little Mr. Perfect. I became captain of this and chairman of that and head of that. And still, to this day and age, is a part of me that still wants to please you so much. But I'm working on that. But the message in that home was, I will love you if you're perfect. And I became Mr. Little Perfect. One of the positive features of that was being able to study well, I got good grades. And being aggressive and competitive and overachiever with good grades, there's only one place you end up, and that's medical school. And at age 17, I got into medical school. And at age 22, I graduated with an MD. Which some of you will think stands for Doctor of Medicine, and in my case it stood for Malignant Denial. I determined at a very early age that I was never going to let my family go through what I was going through. And at age 16 in Glasgow, I had my first drink of alcohol. I'd always felt a bit different. I'd always felt I didn't quite belong. Always felt a little bit insecure and shy and embarrassed and never quite right. I realized now what I was doing was comparing my insides to your outsides, and your outsides looked okay and my insides felt so terrible. But when I had that drink at age 16, although I got drunk that night, for a moment in time or a period in time, I felt normal. And from that time, every time I took alcohol to be normal, and that's very important to me. You see, when I was confronted by two wives, when I was confronted by several big children, when I was confronted by lawyers, by police force, by judges, by the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, by various key members in my life who said, Graham, dad, husband, doctor, please don't drink, I was sober. Because what these good people in my life failed to realize was that alcohol wasn't the problem to me. Sobriety was the problem. I've learned that when you take alcohol away from alcoholism, you're left with the ism, the I, self, and me. And the problem was my ism kept turning up. And I couldn't stand me sober, and so I had to change the way I felt. One of my hobbies, and some of you know this, is watching social drinkers. You have to laugh at them. One of the diagnostic signs, if I can call it that, of social drinkers is people at a party will stand with their glass, and you'll come up to offer them something else, and this is how you diagnose a social drinker. They put their hand on top of the glass. We never did that. Social drinkers do that. Then they say, no thanks, I'm starting to feel it. I wanted the feeling. I liked the way it felt with alcohol. And even though that night at age 16 when I had my first drink, in the second floor apartment, in the parlor, with a blue rug, pale blue wallpaper, five glasses on the tray, which had a thistle emblem on it, The girl was 5'2", with blonde hair and a black cap in her tooth, and the beverage was Johnny Walker Red Label. You can tell it was a very momentous event in my life. I can't remember my first bout of diarrhea. I can't remember my first hamburger, but I sure as hell remember that first drink, because, you know, it filled the hole in my soul. It made me feel normal. And that night I got drunk, I went home, I threw up, and I went to bed. But in that house, we were keeping secrets. And now, 34 years later, my Scottish mother has still not said to me, "How come you came home that night drunk?" Still hasn't said it. We are as sick as, I am as sick as I seek my secrets. But that night something happened. I made a conscious decision to use this stuff. This stuff works. And thereafter, in the rest of my drinking career, I always used alcohol to be normal. To dance, to make love, to laugh, to cry, to whatever. To be normal. But I didn't realize that I had a disease that, by definition, I would always drink more than I needed. I went to a meeting recently and somebody stood up and he said his name was Doug and he was an alcoholic and his drug of choice was more. And I could really relate to that. I always wanted more. The compulsion to take more was there, and I've learned that's the difference between me and social drinkers, whatever they are. They can stop. I thought I could stop, but I didn't. What happened was I would pass out, I would black out, I'd run out of money, or I'd get arrested. The stopping was forced on me. And I've discovered in my alcoholism that stopping really wasn't a problem. Starting was the problem. I would make promises that I wouldn't do it again, only to do it again, because I forgot the promise. My father got progressively worse and finally died in 1975 of his disease of alcoholism, and it was never going to happen in my home. People would say to me, early on in medical school, "You drink too much, you don't drink like us." And I'd say, "Yes, I'm not an alcoholic, because my father's an alcoholic, he drinks every day. I only drank on weekends at that point." As I went on in my drinking, I would compare my disease with his disease, not realizing that what I had was progressive. And I was just further down, further behind my father in terms of the things that were happening to him. And all the things that happened to him, including death, were to happen to me. I graduated from medical school in the top 5 in my year. I don't tell you that to impress you. I tell you that to tell you that one can achieve a lot while actively practicing the disease of alcoholism. I got a good job in Scotland. I specialized in a particular branch of medicine, and then life started to tighten up. I got my first impaired driving charge, and I discovered that I was not able to work as well on Mondays because I would drink only Saturdays and Sundays, but Mondays was starting to be a lost day for me. And I began to become more and more uncomfortable with people around me, beginning to wonder, who knows what I'm doing? I developed a little voice in my head that went on for a number of years, and that little voice said, "If you really knew me, if you really knew the things that I was doing and the person I was becoming, you would never speak to me again and you would leave." And I was developing what I call the twins of my alcoholism, shame and fear. Shame of what I was becoming and fear that you were going to find out. And ultimately, having found out, that you would leave me. And so I went to my boss in Glasgow, Scotland, and I said, "Boss, I'm thinking of going to Canada." "Good idea, Graham," he said. I think he could see in me someone that wasn't reliable on a Friday afternoon and was nowhere to be seen on a Monday morning. I think he was a wise man who could see my disease, but like so many earth people, didn't know what to say to me, didn't know how to confront this, didn't want to embarrass me. And so I was married to a Scottish lady at that time, my drinking buddy, and we came to Canada together, and I set up private practice as a family doctor in a lovely little town called Parry Sound, Ontario, on Georgian Bay, put my shingle out, and that meant OHIP, and OHIP stands for "Oh, How It Pays." I have to say to you now, in my own defense, I'm no longer paid by OHIP, I'm a salaried physician, I just say that. The point I'm making is the money started to come in, and as the money came in, so the drinking increased. The reason I only drank on weekends as a student and as a young doctor was because that was all I could afford. But as the money came in, you see, I began to develop the classy drinking, the wine cellar. You know, a wine connoisseur is just a wino with a checkbook. And I became a wino with a checkbook. And out of the two or three cocktails before dinner, except for the nights when I was in call for emergencies and covering my practice. And then there were other chemicals that I would use. There was vitamin V, Valium, and there was some narcotics and that kind of thing. And I won't get into that because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. But you need to know that I use chemicals to be normal, always. Life became more difficult. I had another impaired driving charge. I realized now, as an alcoholic, I could commit to only one thing, and that was my alcohol. Getting the alcohol, using the alcohol, hiding the alcohol. You see, I was always a secret drinker. I wasn't going to be like my father, who was a highly visible, falling down, drunk dog. And I wasn't going to be that way. I drank in secret. I kept it in drawers. I hid it in the trunk. I hid it under the seat of my car. You would never see me drinking. I've discovered that the center of my personal disease is isolation. The core of my disease is isolation. I was utterly alone in my disease, and I believe that's often the same for a lot of us. Utterly alone. And who do you tell of the pain? Who understands the shame? Who understands the fear? Because, you see, I began to be able to see some of the things I was doing as not right. I hear people coming into AA and saying, I never knew I was an alcoholic till I came here. I wasn't like that because I could at least see myself in some aspects of my father's illness. And so I knew in my heart of hearts, this isn't right. I had a couple of kids by this time. I came home one day, note in the fridge, I can't stand you, and she took off. My first wife left, ran off with the local sheriff. Remember that song, Who Shot the Sheriff? The point is, she was right to leave. Her needs and wants were not being met. It wasn't a good marriage. I couldn't commit to anything but drinking. Her leaving gave me a wonderful resentment. Left me with two little kids. Poor me. And poor me leads to pour me a drink, as you all know. And the drinking got even worse. I went back to Toronto, stayed in Toronto for a little while, moved back up to Parry Sound. A year and a half later, met my now wife. On the first date, she made the diagnosis. She said, you're an alcoholic. And I said, you're a nurse, I'm a doctor. Mind your own damn business, I'll make the diagnosis. But she was right. I had a young man in my office in 1975, and this time I was drinking about a bottle of scotch a day, except for the times when I was in call and other things would be used those days. I would use narcotics to come off in the morning and get rid of the hangover because I wasn't one to be smelling of booze when I went to work. And this young man came into my office with his liver down to his knees and he was bright yellow and his belly was full of fluid and he was covered in red blotches. And smart doctor that I am, I said, you've got cirrhosis. You have to stop drinking. And he disappeared. And he came back 6 months later and walked into my office just like Abby Thatcher walking into Bill Wilson's kitchen. And the guy looked terrific. He had a suit on, eyes were clear, fluid in his belly had disappeared, red blotches had gone. I said, Terry, you look fantastic. He said, yes, doc. He said, I'm sober. I said, how are you doing that? Feeling so threatened by the fact that he was sober and I couldn't be. He said, I'm going to a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And in my very arrogant way, I said to him, well, I'm developing an interest in this disease, alcoholism. Maybe I'll come to the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And he made the remark, the Alcoholics Anonymous remark, I'll pick you up, doc. And I made the alcoholic's response, no thanks, I'll get there myself. And I was started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in the fire hall in Parry Sound. And with all respect, I don't mean to point you out, but I sat in the back row. And I'm always suspicious of people in the back row because I sat back there for weeks and months making diagnoses. The speaker would stand up and say, oh, he's depressed. And the lady would stand up, well, it must be a diabetes. And I would leave meetings and I'd go and drink. But I was aware of the honesty, and I was aware that here was a program that was keeping a bunch of people sober. But of course, I wasn't like you. I had another disease that I've come to call terminal uniqueness. It manifests in me in two simple words. Yes, but. I know what you're telling me, and I know the rest of the world has to do this, but I'm different. And I really did believe that. I believed there would be a medical textbook that they would eventually discover with my last name and itis after it as a disease of one, and that would be me. I really thought I was unique. We get married. We had another little boy. And we moved to Timmins. Alcoholics keep moving. A small town was just too small for me. I was getting into problems. I wasn't consistent in my marriage. I was doing a lot of other things in the community. And my partner started to be complaining, be concerned. And so I moved. And we moved to Timmins. And I was in Timmins for the rest of my drinking career. I would go off in binges. You see, I was never going to let you see you behave the way my father did, so I'd go off in binges. Father Joe Martin from Pennsylvania said that when he drank, he'd break out in spots. And I could relate to that. You know, Winnipeg and Chicago and Buffalo and places like that. Blackouts were always a major part of my drinking, I'm afraid. I would sit it and I'd start drinking with you, and I'd sit and pinch my right thigh, and I'd say, don't black out, don't black out, don't black up. And I'd wake up in the morning somewhere, and I would have a terrible hangover and a huge bruise in my right thigh from pinching myself. And I would have blacked out. I remember one terrible night I woke up in a hotel room and I had one shoe and sock on and one shoe and sock off. And my first dilemma was, am I getting up or am I going to bed? And I looked at my watch and it was 6:15. And the second dilemma was, is this at night or in the morning? And so I went and looked out the window of this hotel and the traffic was moving. So I said, well, it's good. It must be the evening. I can get a drink. You know, very sick thinking. Not realizing it was the drink that got me there in the first place. Life got worse and worse. I began to have convulsions when I stopped drinking, and so I couldn't stop drinking. And I began to disappear and waking up in Skid Row. And this happened, I'd disappear for a month or two. People would find me, bring me back to practice, and I'd start to practice again. And it's amazing how quickly you can generate money as a physician in private practice, even very disabled. One war story I do tell, to give an example of how it is possible for me as a trained physician to practice my profession very impaired, was one Saturday evening in Timmins. I am a cardiologist, a heart specialist, that's my background, although I don't do that now. And there was two of us in Timmins working alternate nights and alternate weekends. Now, when you're a daily drinker, that's tough. But my buddy Cam was on call this Saturday night for cardiology for people with heart disease. And a man came into the emergency room who needed a pacemaker. His heart rate was down to 12 beats a minute, and he tried to get a pacemaker, a wire, into his heart. And it's a simple technique, but sometimes it can be awkward, and Cam couldn't do it. So he phoned me up, his buddy, his sidekick, his partner, at 11:30 on the Saturday night. Well, what's the self-respecting alcoholic doing but drinking? And Cam says, Graham, he says, I'm having a terrible problem with this pacemaker. I wonder if you'd come in and help me. This guy's about to pass through. Now, the social drinker would have said, Cam, I've had a couple of belts. I don't want to come in. The alcoholic, I'll be right there. The Visine, the breath freshener, and straight down to the hospital. Into emergency, get the mask on so they can't smell your breath. Up to the operating room, and they have a little machine, a little timer, on the x-ray control machine, because you put the wire into the heart under x-ray control so you can see what you're doing. And has a timer on it to tell you how long this poor unsuspecting patient has been exposed to x-rays. So I knew how long it took me to put this pacemaker wire in. Remember, the completely sober, competent cardiologist couldn't do it. The impaired cardiologist took 2.5 minutes. Now, if I had stopped there, there would have been no problem, but I'm an alcoholic. So I then proceeded to tell them all what they were doing wrong and how they could fix it. I then told them what the Ministry of Health was doing wrong in terms of running the hospital and how they could fix it, and then I went home. I came in the next day expecting all kinds of plaudits and patting you on the back, and this is great, and thank you for saving old Joe's life, and that was just terrific. And they were all in corners speaking. And I walked in and they all went silent. You had that treatment? And then I got the letter. Please present yourself before the medical review committee at 7 a.m. next Monday morning. They had morning breakfast meetings. And I was being summoned to be told, you know, how come you come in loaded? This was July in Timmins. Now, I would get up in the morning, I'd drink to 2-3 in the morning, and earth people would have been in coma for a week, but not us guys. 6:30 we were up, breakfast of champions, cigarette and 5 pounder number 3, and straight into work. I get up at 6:30 ready for this 7 o'clock morning, and I was really having withdrawal. I was very shaky inside, I was freezing cold, and so I put on a coat and a muffler, a cap and dark glasses. This is 7 a.m. in July in Timmins, and I walked into the committee room to be interviewed looking exactly like that. And the same deal, I walked in and they all stopped talking. So I sat down and they looked at me and I looked at them, and they were nice people. You know, we don't need nice people as alcoholics, and they didn't know what to say to me. And I didn't know what to say to them. So I solved the problem. I passed out. And that was to begin the sort of passing out in my own hospital routine, which is quite embarrassing when you're a doctor. It's difficult to maintain your professional panache when you pass out in your own emergency room and waking up in a hospital bed. And I asked the nurse if I could smoke, and she said no, so I signed myself out. I go home, have a shower, come back, and start working again. One time I woke up in the intensive care unit, out of a blackout, and I was in my own intensive care unit. I was director of this intensive care unit, and here I was in bed number 4. I had 2 intravenouses going. I had a tube in my bladder, which is no fun, and I had daisies stuck to my chest and a machine going beep, 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 beep. And now you don't like to ask what happened because you don't want to tell anyone you had a blackout, you know? So I lay there for a little while and I thought, well, I might as well get something out of this. So I began to tap the little daisy on my chest, and the machine went beep, 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 twice as fast. And the nurse came up and said, are you having pain? Yes, morphine. So I got some nice morphine, and that kind of took the edge off the anxiety, and I began to ask questions. What had happened was I'd passed out at home, and I began to get into problems with my heart, irregularities, and I would faint with the irregularities, and I needed to go on pills for this, and this kind of stuff. And everyone was saying, are you drinking? And I'd say no. At one point, they flew a cardiologist up overnight from Toronto to care for me because I was too sick to move in Timmins. Still didn't stop drinking. We had a mixed pregnancy who were twin boys, and some of you know this, little Ian and Brian, they're identical twin boys. We call them Irritate and Agitate. And by this time, my wife was starting to go to some Al-Anon meetings, and I said to her, you know, we've got five kids now. You need to get fixed. And she says, She says, you get fixed. So about a year later, I went in to get fixed. I don't like to rush into things, you know. The 3rd of January, 1986, I drank till 3 in the morning, and I was going in for day surgery, and the deal is you're going at 8 in the morning, and the nurse puts the intravenous up, and you get an injection of Valium, and I was looking forward to that. And then they take you up to the operating room, and they do the number. Well, I was kind of doing this the night before, and the nurse was nervous to start the intravenous in the doctor, and we never got a vein. I got lots of bruises, but no vein. And so I'm wheeled into the operating room, wide awake, coming off the stuff the night before, feeling really rotten. And one of my colleagues begins to do the vasectomy. And halfway through it, I remember him saying something about, was I working that afternoon? And I remember saying vaguely something about, no, I'm going to take the day off. The next thing I knew, I woke up in that operating room, and it was filled with people. And believe me, it was almost as many people as in this room. And what had happened was my heart had stopped. I got into a rhythm that wouldn't sustain life. They call it a cardiac arrest. And, of course, they called this code, and they banged away. I don't remember, but they did all kinds of stuff. And I woke up, and everyone was panicking, everyone was very tense and nervous and anxious. What happened for me during that time was what the psychiatrist subsequently told me was what they call an out-of-body experience. Now, what I saw was my alcoholism. I saw my disease as clearly as my wives must have seen it, my secretary must have seen it, my big kids must have seen it, my mother must have seen it. I had a moment in that operating room of clarity that I can't really explain to you, except I saw my disease and I knew that if I go on like this, I'm going to die. I wish I could put into words the fear I felt when I came out of that disaster. I was filled with a fear that I've never had since, thank God. And I screamed for my wife, get me the hell out of here. They wanted me to stay. I said, I'm not staying. They threatened to certify me as being insane, and I threatened to sue them. And you can imagine the whole scene. My wife came, she brought clothes, long-suffering wife, brought my clothes, and I signed myself out against advice and went home and began to drink, because that's all I knew. But that young man, Terry, in my office 11 years before, I'm staying sober with a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could hear his voice. And I said to Linda, I'm going to die. I think we must call Alcoholics Anonymous. I must get better. This can't go on. It's about 9 o'clock at night. She looked up the phone number in AA. I had lost the ability to read by that time. I had quite a bit of damage intellectually. I couldn't read well. I couldn't write. You would talk to me. Your lips were moving. It might as well be Swahili. I had trouble grasping ideas. I really was damaged. I didn't know this at the time. It was only with hindsight. We dialed AA, or she dialed AA, and she handed me the phone, and the voice said, Alcoholics Anonymous, how can I help you? That's it for me. How can I help you, said the voice. And I said, I'm in trouble. I want to quit drinking, and I'm scared. And the voice said, where are you? And I told him my address. I'll be right over. 30 seconds later, literally, at the door. I thought the guy was at the end of the driveway with a cellular phone waiting for my car. And this was Bill H. and Timmons. And Bill had the AA phone, and Bill lived two doors down from me. God could and would if he were sought. I'd just been seeking in the wrong places. And Bill sat in my kitchen that night, the 3rd of January, 1986, and he listened to me and my tales of woe and all the things that were wrong with the world and why I drank the way I did, and watched me cry into a towel. And he listened to my wife's rage and my wife's frustration, and he heard the sobbing of my big kids who were still at home, and my little guys were sound asleep in bed. And he heard the story of the 14-year-old son who had held me across the table with a knife at my throat and said, I could kill you, you bastard, for what you're doing to my mother. And he heard the story of the 7-year-old daughter coming off the school bus with the tears streaming down her face and said to me, Daddy, all the way home the boys were saying you were a drunk. And he listened to all that stuff. And he gave me hope because he treated me with respect. He taught me that night, and I learned it that night, to instill hope, we must deal with respect. That was my first lesson in AA. He treated me with courtesy. I learned that night. He said, we have no detoxes in this area, but why don't you come to my basement? And I went and I got what I now learned to know is Bill's basement treatment. And Bill had a little tape machine in his basement and an endless coffee pot. And he said to me, how old are you? And I said, I'm 40. And he got a 40-year-old man from AA who came over, told me his story. We listened to a tape, drank a cup of coffee, and the guy went home. He said, where are you from? I said, I'm Scottish. He said, got a Scotsman from AA, came over, told me his story. We listened to a tape, and then we drank a coffee, and he went home. What do you do? I'm a doctor. He got a doctor. He had someone in AA to match my every single need that night, the next day, and Sunday. On Monday, I was back in my office chemical-free for the first time in years. Now, I didn't feel very good, and I wasn't working. I was just sitting there because I didn't know where else to go. And the phone rang, and this doc who'd done the visit on me and the 12-step call on me that Saturday night in Bill's basement said, "I've got you into a treatment center." And I was flown down to a treatment center on Wednesday. The Wednesday night was my last drunk, the 8th of January 1986, and the next day I was admitted to a treatment facility. I was sitting in the lobby of that treatment facility, and I was feeling an inch high. I was unshaven, I was sweating, I was shaky, I was sick. I had a t-shirt on, a pair of jeans and a pair of sneakers, and I had a backpack with a change of underwear, a pair of socks and a shirt. And I was sitting there feeling so ashamed and so frightened. And a little blonde lady came up and sat down beside me. She said, "I've been here a week. I guess it feels pretty rough." And I said, "You better believe it." She said, "Well, it does get better." I said, "Well, I should know better. I'm a doctor." And she said, "So am I. I've been here a week." And I could have hugged her. Because, you see, I thought I was the only doctor in the world like this. And here was this woman that God put in my way that day to say, "It is okay. I love you just the way you are." The conditional love I got at home, you gave me unconditionally, and it started that day. I need to tell you, I admitted that lady doctor to my service last week for treatment. I don't know why I've stayed sober and she hasn't, but what a gift to be able to return something to her. And I sat down with her that day as she came into my center, and I was able to say to her, "Thank you for what you did for me 8 years ago." Everything happens for a reason. I went through treatment there, and they gave me an extended program, I guess, because I was kind of resistant with this malignant denial and the intellectualizing and all the other games that I would play. But I went to my first AA meeting in that center completely sober, and that was important for me. And John T. was a speaker, and he stood up, and he said, "I've been sober for 16 years, and he held up this little 24-hour book, and he said, "I'm reading this for the 16th time, and I read it every morning, and I ask for strength to stay sober in the morning, and I say thank you at night before I go to bed, and so far that's worked." And I thought, I'm going to try that. So at coffee afterwards, I went up to him and I said, "Tell me about this in the morning, this praying business." He said, "Well, you have to pray." I said, no. I said, "I'm from Scotland." I said, "Even the dogs don't bark on Sundays over there. I don't believe in this prayer stuff." He said, "Well, you're going to have to talk to something." And I said, "Who'd you talk to, John?" He said, "Talk to anyone you want." So I went to my room in the treatment center, and I got down on my knees and I talked to the tree outside the window. And I always get emotional when I'm saying this. I said, "I'm scared. And I don't know who I'm talking to. But I can't do this alone. And I need help." And I climbed into bed that night, and for the first time in a long, long time, I slept properly. I got a pass from that treatment facility about a month later. My wife was down for family program, and they allowed me out for the weekend, and I went out with my wife, and we went to a restaurant. And I looked at people with drinking, and the compulsion to drink had gone. And all I had done that night, I know now, I didn't know it then, but that now, was I had surrendered. My sponsor said, "It's real simple. It's the three pertinent ideas. A, you're alcoholic and couldn't manage your life. B, no human power could. C, God couldn't would if he was sought." And that night, I sought him unconditionally. I can't do this alone. I need help. So simple, but so hard. And I've done that ever since. And I've discovered that as I've gone on in recovery and sobriety, I've learned more about my recovery by looking back and recognizing that the beginning that night for me was that event that night was the beginning of a spiritual awakening, an awareness of another force in my life. I got back to Timmins, I got off the plane, and my wife and my five kids met me, which was really nice. But Al and Joe from AA met me, which was even nicer. And Al said, "We're going to take you to a meeting tonight." And I remember Terry 11 years before saying, "Okay, Doc, I'll pick you up." And me saying, "No, I'll get there myself." And I said to Al, "Okay, Al," I said, "when does it start?" He said, "8 o'clock, I'll pick you up." And I said, "Fine, I'll be ready." And he came to my place about 7:25. The next day on the way home, he said, "I'll pick you up tomorrow night." And I felt a bit uncomfortable with that because I thought he was starting to baby me a bit, and I resented that. And I said, "Okay, I'll see you." And he picked me up at 7:25. And on the way home after that meeting that night, he said, "I'll pick you up tomorrow night." And I really resented that. But of course, I'm keeping secrets. I'm still sick. So I said, "I'll show him. I'll leave at 7:15. So I left at 7:15 to get in my own car, and Al was at the end of my driveway with Joe in his car. He knew alcoholics. And these guys literally picked me up for my first 30 meetings. I thought they were just nice. Now I realize they didn't trust me. They didn't trust my disease. And they're right. And I began going to meetings. I walked into those meetings, and a guy called Marcel stuck his hand out and said, "Welcome, we've been waiting for you." I thought, how the hell did he know? Didn't realize it was a standard AA line. And I looked in Marcel's eyes, and I wanted what his eyes had. He had great big white eyeballs, and mine were red and yellow and just looked rotten. And I wanted his white eyeballs. It's regular. You used to read, "If you want what we've got." Well, I wanted Marcel's eyeballs. And so I kept going back to meetings to get Marcel's eyeballs. You see, in 1976, I'd been given a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous by a guy called Fred A., who'd seen me sitting in the back row, smelled me sitting in the back row, and recognized I needed help, so he gave me his big book, a big book, signed A Grateful Alcoholic, Fred A. So I opened it, and I saw the doctor's opinion. I thought, I don't need that, I'm a doctor. Forget the doctor's opinion. Bill's story. I don't know Bill, what the hell do I want to know his story for? And then more about, what do you mean more? I mean, I'm not an alcoholic. So I closed it. I've since discovered that the heaviest weight an alcoholic picks up is the cover of that big book. I've learned that if you want to hide something from an alcoholic, you put it in the big book. My two big kids are now at university. I love them dearly. They may have my disease, and one of them I think has. And when they left, I gave them both a copy of the big book. And in that big book, I put an undated check for a sizable sum of money. Not huge, huge, but to me, a Scotsman, anything over a buck, sizable. One child has cleared that check through my account. One hasn't. The one I think that needs to open that book hasn't. And I'll be really very pleased as his father when he does. Because it means he started to open that cover and say, maybe, just maybe, there's something in here that might just help me, because I don't think I can do it alone. Jack became my first sponsor, Third Step Jack up in Timmins, and Jack gave me AA rules, and they were really quite simple. He said, you'll go early, and you'll stay late. Why, Jack? He said, because isolation is the dark room where you develop your negatives. You must not be alone. Okay, Jack, I won't be alone. He said, you will drink coffee even if you detest coffee. Why, Jack? Because you're not different, you son of a gun. He said, you will always sit in the same seat. In fact, you'll sit in that seat so often that people come into the hall and you're not in that seat, they'll think they're in the wrong hall. He said, you will identify yourself as an alcoholic at every single meeting, whether you believe it or not. And I said, how long do I have to do this, Jack? He said, till you like it. And I went to a meeting a day for 2.5 years. And after about 6 months, Jack said to me, he said, what do you think about these steps? And I said, well, they seem to make some sense. I hear them read at every meeting, and I see them in a list on the wall, and I'm starting to feel that I should do some of them because I want to be just like you guys. You're happy, serene, joyous, and free, and you tell me you go up and down the steps, so maybe we should start doing them. He said, you any problem with the first one? And I said, no. I can understand it. When I drank, I couldn't guarantee the outcome. I understand that when I drank, my life really got crazy. I couldn't commit to my relationships. I couldn't commit to my job. I couldn't commit to my family. He said, what about coming to believe that there's something in here that can restore you to sanity? I said, I don't think I'm insane. He said, okay. He said, let me give you my definition of insanity. He said, it is insane to think that a behavior that always has resulted in one particular outcome will somehow now, this time, result in a different outcome. He said, let me put this in English because you're really a dummy, Graham. He said, when I get in my car tonight and put it in D, it has been my experience over 30 years of driving, it's going to go forward. It would be insane tonight to think somehow, just for a change, it will go backwards. He said, when you drank, you thought it somehow, just this time, it would be different. Are you coming to believe that there's something in this group of drunks in Timmins that can restore you to sanity, healthy thinking? And I said, yes. He said, are you prepared to turn your will and your life over to this group of drunks on a daily basis by coming to meetings? And I said, yes. He said, okay, you've done the first 3 steps to the best of your ability. Why don't you do step 4 and 5 from the big book? He said, please. Don't do them from the list on the wall, do them from the book. He said, page 64 through 69, all you need to know about resentments, fears, and sex problems that would harm other people. Look beyond the anger and the resentments and the fears and the sex behaviors at your own problems, your own defects, your own difficulties, and share them with God for humility, yourself, based with God for honesty, yourself for forgiveness, and another human being for humility. And I did that, but Father Les Costello did a 5th step, and I floated home. And my wife had been away with the kids in Parry Sound, and she came back and she looked in my eyes and she said, you know, remember you were telling me about Marcel's eyeballs? And I said, yep. She said, well, I'm looking in yours and I can see that the tombstones have gone. The tombstones have gone. I was learning to live before I'd been learning to die. I realized that having done a 5th step and starting in the 6th and 7th, I learned that you were offering me humility without humiliation. That is so important to this alcoholic, because I humiliated myself time and time again. To walk in, someone whispers, "He's here." I didn't have to go back to that. True love, someone said to me recently, is the act of bringing you back to yourself. And you showed me true love by telling me, do fourth and fifth step to the best of your ability now. We will bring you back to yourself. We love you just the way you are. What a gift. What a joy. Make a list of people you've harmed, please. And when you're ready, go to them and say, "I'm sorry." Be the husband your wife's entitled to. Be the father your children are entitled to. Be the best physician your patients can have. And then if there's anyone else, go to them and just say, "Look, I'm sorry." And I did that. My last amend on that list was in 1990 to the doctor that brought me to Canada, that offered me my first job in 1970, who in 1973 reported me to my licensing body for behaviours that he could not accept. And I turned round and said many things to him and his family. He's now in his 70s, and I knew that this man was eventually going to die and that I would go to his funeral because I would feel I'd have to, and if I'd not spoken with him, my insides would have been in a mess again. And so I called him up and I said, "Peter, I'd like to meet with you." And I went up to his house. He's now retired, and we sat in his dock overlooking the bay in Georgian Bay, lovely little spot. And I said, "Peter, what happened between you and I in 1973, you were right and I was sick. And I'm sorry for the pain that I caused you. You trusted me, you gave me your friendship and you gave me your love, and I wrecked it, and I'm very sorry. I was ill, and I'm getting better through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, A Day at a Time." And I don't know whether he understood that or not. I stood up to leave, and I was stepping into my van, and he called my name, and I turned around, and he walked up, and he gave me a hug. And I floated out of his driveway. A week later to the day, I was at a fancy, swanky hotel downtown Toronto at a medical convention, and I'm walking down a long corridor, and who should be coming towards me but that very doctor. Had I not done what you told me to do, I would have walked past him with my eyes on the ground, hating my guts. But because I did what you told me to do, I was able to stop and look him in the eye and pass the time of day. Having got to the ninth step, you gave me the gift of being equal. Thank God for making me equal. And then you said, "Look, don't stop there, Graham. There's three more steps." And I did 10th, 11th and 12th on a daily basis. And things went well. At 18 months, I began to have rages. I realized that when I stop alcohol and other things, my life for a while got more difficult. And as I worked through the steps and the compulsion and difficulties with alcohol disappeared, my living problems continued. And at 18 months of sobriety, I had to leave work again, and this time go into treatment for something else, a psychiatric disorder. I had been the route of psychiatrists. You know, a lot of us have. And I really believe that every AA member should have his own psychiatrist, because they really do badly need our help. As a doctor, when I was ill, one of the things we doctors do is we go for the appropriate ologist. You know, if you've got a bad chest, you see a chestologist. If you've got hemorrhoids, you see a bumologist. You know, you don't go to a family doctor. And when I went through that review committee, they recommended I go see a psychiatrist, because any doctor that comes in drinking at night has to be insane. You see, so they send me to see a psychiatrist. And these psychiatrists are really nice people. The ones I met didn't know diddly squat about alcoholism, but nice people. They sat and listened, and they were very supportive and caring. And one man, I remember him well, his name was Ron, and he gave me a prescription for medication. And as I'm walking out of his office, holding this prescription, he said, "Oh, by the way, Graham," he said, "those pills I gave you," he said, "if you drink in those pills, one drink will seem like two drinks." Well, I really coasted in those pills for a long time. I'd been searching for them for a while. But I discovered at 18 months of sobriety, I needed some other help. And I dealt with issues coming from the alcoholic background that I grew up in. And that was part of the journey I was able to continue on. And the secret for me was to get sober first. Solid, solid sober first. And then I could begin to deal with everything else. And I was told by very wise men and women, if you put anything ahead of your sobriety, you're on the risk of losing it. If I put my family ahead of my sobriety, my job ahead of my sobriety, my program ahead of my sobriety, not my program, anything else ahead of my sobriety, I ran the risk of losing it. That was tough for me to hear, tough for me to learn. But learn it I did. And then I began to look at expanding career. I got out of Timmins, we moved to Toronto, and then relocated in Guelph. I've discovered in alcohol, recovery from alcoholism, in sobriety, I can have healthy choices. I can take risks, I can make mistakes, and that's okay. After about 6.5 years, I became aware that I was getting bored, I was getting complacent, meetings were kind of ho-hum. I had done everything I thought I needed to do, and there was no more fun in sobriety. And so I began to think, well, maybe I need to change my group. Maybe I need to change my sponsor. Began to get into my own thoughts. Jack told me in the first meeting, he said, you look at that slogan that says, think, 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 change it to don't, don't, don't. Jack told me that when I was thinking, I was behind enemy lines. Jack told me that if you're ever having difficulties, go and talk to someone about it. And in 6.5 years sober, I did all the opposite things. I stopped sharing, I stopped talking, and I started to cut down in meetings. Once a year as a family, three now, used to be five now, three children, my wife and myself, go to a big convention often in the States. And 2 years ago, we went to a meeting in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And the boys go to Al-Adud, my wife goes to Al-Anon, and I go to AA. And a fellow called Burns B. from Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky. You love these American speakers. You know, you can smell the smoke and feel the heat when they get going. Got up and started to talk about how at 7 years of sobriety, he became complacent and discovered he was working a four-step program. Steps 1, 2, 3, and 12. And I thought, that's me. He said he was falling apart. He was angry. He was resentful. He was starting to keep secrets again. And I thought, that's me. And he said, what I discovered was I had to go back home and work through the steps again. So I came back to Guelph. I went to Punchy, my sponsor. And I said, Punchy, I need to go through the steps again. He said, well, funny you should mention that, Graham. I just happened to have put together a group of eight guys. We've got a workbook written by Dr. Paul O from the Big Book. And we're going to work through the 164 pages of the Big Book. And we're all going to work through the 12 steps together. Why don't you join us? And for 22 weeks, I began again and worked through the 12 steps again. A friend of mine, Joe McMillan, and he doesn't mind me breaking his anonymity in Toronto, described a cottage to me. He said, this cottage is our only cottage in the lake. It's a silver lake. It's smooth. It's always warm. The silver birches off in the distance. It's on the heron's nest, and every now and again the heron comes out and flies across in front of this cottage. And he said, it's a wonderful spot. And the name of the cottage is Contented Sobriety. And he said, people try to get there by powerboat, and people try and get by submarine, and people try and get in by helicopter, and people try and get in the back door. He said, the only way you can get into Contented Sobriety is by walking and working up the 12 steps at the front of that cottage. And if you want to get back to Contented Sobriety, you've got to go up the steps at the front of the cottage again. And second time round, I learned that. I learned that if I want to have contented sobriety, I need to continue to work the steps. The 10th, 11th, and 12th on a daily basis are crucial for me now. Crucial. Every morning, quiet time with some prayer. Prayer for me to a God that I now understand. I no longer call a group of drunks a God of my understanding. I'm not sure who I talk to, but it works. To be honest as I can, to be open to things you tell me. And if I don't go to meetings, I don't get to hear the things I need to hear. And so I go to meetings. And my God, as I understand him, talks to me through you. Meditation for me is simply listening. And when I listen, things happen like, why don't you call your mother? Why don't you write a letter to your sister? Why don't you do... I discover ideas that take me out of myself. The self-centered alcoholic becomes a little bit less self-centered by meditating. And in the 12th step, giving it away to keep it. 2 years ago, the phone rang. And it was a doctor I work with. Psychiatrist, actually. And he said, I need to talk to you. He said, could you come round to my house? I didn't know what he wanted. I said, sure, John. I said, fine. He said, what about this evening? So I went round to his house about 9 o'clock. It was snowing. And I got there and I went into his kitchen. And he was holding a towel and he was crying. And he said, I'm an alcoholic and I can't stop drinking. And he told me all the reasons why he was drinking. And he told me all the things that were going wrong in his life. And I listened to his wife's rage. And I listened to his wife's anger. And again, we agreed that he and I would go to a meeting the next night. And subsequently, he agreed into treatment in a treatment center in Toronto. And he still goes to AA, and I'm now his sponsor. But that night, as I drove home in the car, I discovered it was the 3rd of January, 1990. 4 years to the day that Bill dropped into my kitchen in Timmins and did exactly the same thing with me. The only difference for me that night was I wasn't drinking. I had learned the lesson that to keep this, I must give it away. To keep this, I must offer unconditional love. To keep this, I must learn to laugh at myself. Most importantly, myself. What a gift. What a joy. When I called Bill that night, I just wanted to quit drinking. I had no idea of the wonderful things that were going to happen to me. Of a family who can tell me exactly what they think, honestly, and equally. Driving to a ball game recently with my twins on a Saturday morning, and I like to go to the Saturday morning meeting in Guelph because I enjoy it. And I said to the twins, I said, listen, fellas, I'm going to drop you off at your game, and I want you to donate half an hour of your game so my meeting can finish, and then I'll leave and I'll come to the rest of your game. And little Ian, the younger of the twins, said, you better go to that meeting. Remember, you're not cured. We're a family in recovery. We're a family that was sick, and we're a family that's getting better. And it was given to us for fun and for free. I know this isn't AA literature, but I want to read to you a little poem. As part of my own journey, I had to go down to the States and work a lot on issues from childhood. I don't want to get into that. But I really, you gave me the freedom to see that and the chance to work at that. And I met a man called Father Leo Booth. And he talked to me about spirituality. And he told me what a spiritual journey was. And he pointed out to me in the big book, the whole reason for my being and for my program was to fit myself to be a better service to my God and to my fellow person. And he talked to me about spirituality, and I began to understand it. And he shared a poem with me that he got from a woman who was in prison in Massachusetts. And I want to read this to you because it was so helpful and meaningful for me in terms of putting things in context about getting better from an illness rather than getting better from a badness. She told me that after a while you learn the subtle difference between holding a hand and chaining a soul. And you learn that love doesn't mean leaning, and company doesn't mean security. And you begin to learn that kisses aren't contracts, and presents aren't promises. And you begin to accept your defeats with your head up and your eyes ahead, with the grace of a woman or man, not the grief of a child. And you learn to build all your roads on today, because tomorrow's ground is too uncertain for plans. And futures have a way of falling down in mid-flight. After a while, you learn that even sunshine burns if you ask too much. So you plant your own garden and you decorate your own soul instead of waiting for someone to bring you flowers. And you learn that you really can endure, that you really are strong, that you really do have worth. And you learn with every goodbye you learn. When I said goodbye to alcohol that night in the treatment facility, I learned that I just had to ask you for direction and you would give it to me. When I went to meetings, I heard the laughter and felt the unconditional love. We will love you, Graham, no matter who you are, what you've done, or where you've been. And I continue to have that love from you. I can't put into words because I don't have the skill to express my gratitude and my thanks to you. I wish Linda was here because she would say the same thing. You've literally saved my life because I died to get here. You've literally saved the lives of my children. I'm asked to speak in many places now, not necessarily connected with AA, and recently I was giving a lecture at Queen's University to some young doctors about alcoholism and drug addiction in doctors, because obviously of my own background as well as my training. And the audience was with 365 people. And in the back row was a young man, he's 23, who came down to the front, and he brought two other young men, and he said, Dad, this is Steve and this is Mel, my roommates. And he said to Mel and Steve, he said, this is my dad, and I'm real proud of him. And that was a young man who, 10 years ago, thereabouts, was prepared to kill his father because of what he was doing to his mother. And the lesson I learned was, I just had to ask, I had to listen, and I had to do what you told me to do. I remember when I was 18, being taken for the first time to a restaurant like tonight, where there was more than one fork, and I had no idea what to do. So I watched the other people. Didn't have to tonight. Sandy showed me what to do. It was exactly the same when I came to AA. Part of me said, I should know this because I'm an intellect. But thank goodness the healthy part of me said, just listen and you'll learn. If you learn, you can love. And if you love, you can laugh. I'm so grateful for you making me equal. God bless. Thank you.